This is Central Time. Bike share programs have become more of a staple in larger cities over the years, including a few Wisconsin communities. Many have been pushing to move beyond a symbol of downtown novelty into a genuine part of the local transportation system. But with some programs only accepting payments via credit card or smartphone, some people are left unable to participate. Many cities are making moves to make bike share programs more approachable for lower-income residents, including expanded services in underserved neighborhoods. Teresa Wiltz wrote about bike sharing for Stateline. Teresa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of people around the state have seen bike share in action. A lot of people haven't. Can you start by giving us the basics? What is bike share?
So bike sharing is basically where you pick up a bike. It used to be that they were only at a certain station in a certain part of town, but now they're dockless, so you can pick one up anywhere if it's just parked on the sidewalk, and rent it for a short period of time. And they're really popular. They got their start in D.C., where I live, about 10 years ago, and they're really popular among certain sets of folks. And, you know, it's seen as a way you don't have to bring your bike with you everywhere you go, and you can zip from one place to another fairly quickly and easily.
You just mentioned they're associated with a certain set of folks, and you write that they're often associated with more well-to-do, often white audiences. Why is that?
Well, I think it's a perception. I mean, I think one of the things that happened was when it first launched in D.C., which is a predominantly black and brown city, overwhelmingly, but it was mainly the first stations were set up in more tourist-friendly areas, you know, more predominantly white neighborhoods, and so there was not a lot of service in areas that serviced black and brown communities, regardless of income. I mean, I live in a predominantly middle-class homeowner, predominantly homeowning, you know, black and brown neighborhood, and we didn't get bike share stations for quite some time in my neighborhood. So, I mean, I think, and part of that reasoning was that they wanted to, this is a big experiment. It's very popular in Europe, but in the States, it was a new thing. You wanted to prove it could work. So the idea was to kind of try to get the most traffic and the most ridership early on so that you could keep it going and justify the cost of running these programs. So,
and are they seen as successful, at least those first experiments?
The experiments for bike sharing or to expand?
For bike sharing in the first communities they put them in, as you said, the tourist and more well-to-do and higher trafficked areas.
Yes. And it quickly caught on around the country. So, like as I said, D.C. was the first, and then it expanded. I think the next was New York. And other cities around the country quickly picked up. So, they proved to be very popular, and you know, both among tourists and among residents themselves. So,
and you write that a lot of communities now are saying, okay, the next step is getting other people on board, especially people who haven't had access to this or been able to afford it. Is this something you're seeing happen in a lot of cities now?
Yeah, you're starting to see it more. So Philadelphia was the first city to say from the start that they were going to incorporate, you know, think of everyone and try to make it as expansive as possible from the outstart. So so then they launched, I think, in 2015. And from the beginning, they said, okay, we want to make sure everybody's included, that everyone feels included. So they did a lot of outreach. They engaged community ambassadors in neighborhoods to, you know, have bike parties, to, you know, just get people engaged. They also created, for a lot of people who don't have credit cards or access to credit cards, we're increasingly becoming a cash-free society, but for a lot of people, that's a big barrier. You need a credit card to rent a bike or a smartphone. So they created stations at local stores where you could go and pay for your membership in cash, and they also, in 2016, rolled out discounted memberships for lower-income people who receive state benefits. So Philly was the first to really, like, they even had digital literacy classes and bike riding classes together. Like, so they were finding ways to just really get people engaged in, you know, this 21st century style of transportation. new old form of transportation.
And one obvious problem, I guess, is if you're only putting these bike stations at first or the bikes themselves in the tourist area or the higher income parts of town, that's going to lock out a lot of people. Is it just a matter of the geography of where you put these bikes as part of the story here?
That's part of it, yes. I mean, certainly. I mean, and that's the other thing is that both Philadelphia and Detroit, which launched their program last year, made sure that they were expanding, you know, that they were represented in a wide swath of the city, not just, you know, certain exclusive neighborhoods. So, yeah, because in some cities, like in the San Francisco area, there was so much hostility towards this perception that bike shares were for yuppies that someone, I think it was last year, took one of the bike share bikes and totally mutilated it and hung it from a tree and then posted it up on social media. And you had all this, you know, applause and clapping on social media from people who, you know, thought that the bike shares were just for, you know, the avocado toast.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Teresa Wiltz for joining us, senior staff writer covering social services for Stateline. She joined us to talk about bike share programs in cities across the U.S. and initiatives some are taking to make bike sharing more affordable for low-income residents. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. A new study is researching whether taking purified fish oil supplements can slow down some of the health changes that happen in our 50s and 60s that can lead to the development of Alzheimer's. The Wisconsin study focuses on the veteran population, specifically vets who have a family history of Alzheimer's. Dr. Cindy Carlson is leading that study. She's a geriatrics provider at the William S. Middleton Memorial Veterans Hospital and a researcher in the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. She talked to Central Time producer J. Carlisle Larson about the research and the prevalence of Alzheimer's in the United States.
So, Dr. Carlson, before we get to the study itself, can you set the stage a little bit for us? Currently, how many Americans have Alzheimer's?
Right now, we know that over 5 million Americans have Alzheimer's, and the number of people with the disease is increasing. So they expect by 2040 or so that number will triple. So we'll see over 15 million Americans struggling with Alzheimer's disease.
Is there any indication as to why we are seeing an increase with Alzheimer's among Americans?
A lot of it may be because Americans are living longer, so the rates of dementia that we see in people in their 60s, 70s are pretty similar over time, but it's because people are living into their 80s, and the number one risk factor for Alzheimer's is age, that we're seeing a really increased number of people with the disease.
And with an increase that could be pretty exponential over the next 20, 30, 40 years, you know, what could that do for the health system here if we see such a bump?
It'll have tremendous effects on the healthcare system and also on patients and their families. There's a real rippling effect to the impact of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. So I think that, you know, one of the key emphases recently is to really try to focus on preventing Alzheimer's. If we can reduce the number of people with Alzheimer's, or if we can delay it by 5 years, the onset, then we can reduce the number of people with Alzheimer's by 50%. So that would have huge impact on quality of life and cost saving for our healthcare system.
Now, the study that you are going to be conducting looks at a smaller portion of the population. You're looking at veterans. Why are you looking at this population specifically?
We're focusing on veterans because veterans, and specifically veterans who are eligible for VA services, have a higher risk of developing dementia. And it may be in part because they have more exposure to traumatic brain injuries, they tend to have higher rates of depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and also tend to have higher amounts of vascular risk factors, so things like high blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes. And so those things together make them at an increased risk, even over and above the general population for people their age.
The veterans that you're reaching out to for this study, what criteria do they have to reach in order to participate?
In order to participate in this study, they need to be between the ages of 50 to 75 and to have a parent with Alzheimer's disease. So we're trying to reach out for people who probably have an increased risk based on their parental history. And then what we're asking them to do is to come in to see if a certain type of prescription fish oil called Vascepa, to see if that helps change some of the markers that that are associated with Alzheimer's disease development.
And why did you want to look at fish oil specifically as being potentially beneficial with treatment?
Well, we know that there's a lot of data in the recent years that things like high cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes increase our risk for developing dementia. So what we're trying to do is see if some of these therapies that we know can help with those risk factors can actually make a difference in reducing risk for Alzheimer's. However, we don't want to have to do a study that waits 20 years to see if someone gets Alzheimer's. We want to look at other beneficial effects it might have earlier. So for this study, we're focusing on how does it help with brain blood flow? Does it help improve blood flow to the parts of the brain that help protect us against dementia? Or how does it affect key proteins related to Alzheimer's disease, so one called amyloid? Can it lower that and hopefully protect someone's brain against developing dementia? So that's what we're focusing on. Again, a fish oil that we know helps improve blood flow, helps reduce cholesterol levels, to see if that helps beneficially change some of these markers with the hopes that down the road maybe it could be used for Alzheimer's prevention.
We're talking to Dr. Cindy Carlson right now. She is a geriatrics provider at the William S. Middleton Memorial Veterans Hospital and a researcher in the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. She's with us to talk about a study that she is working on that would treat older veterans with fish oil to see if that might stave off Alzheimer's and see what that could look like long term. And so what is the scale, I suppose, of the veterans that you're looking at? And are there any benchmarks that they will hit for you to know, hey, you know what, I'm on a good path here?
That's a great question. So we use these markers. Again, as I mentioned, we don't want to have to wait 20 years and to find out whether or not a medication helps. So we look for these in-between markers. So we look at MRI scans that can show us if some blood flow increases or if it stays the same or decreases over time. So we measure that at baseline in people and then follow it up at 9 months and 18 months to see how that changes over time in each person. So some people will be assigned the high-dose fish oil and some a mineral oil supplement, which looks the same. And then we also measure these specific Alzheimer's proteins called amyloid to see if those change over time as well in response to the fish oil. And then to link it to something that's more practical, we do some thinking tests, a variety of cognitive tests, to kind of see if changes in these what we call biomarkers, the blood flow and the protein levels of amyloid, to see if those help protect people's memory and keep their thinking abilities strong.
What has been some of the feedback that you've gotten on this trial so far? I think it's in the early days, but are people optimistic or are they still waiting to see how it goes?
Well, I think with Alzheimer's, there's been a lot of disappointment in clinical trials in that we haven't really found a breakthrough for either treating the disease or none for preventing the disease. However, there are a lot of good leads and good markers for things that that may tell us about the brain before memory loss symptoms start. So I think there's optimism in looking at a variety of ways for these medications to help improve blood flow to the brain and kind of what we normally think is vascular effects or blood vessel effects. So I think there's optimism. We have had a lot of good interest, and we're still recruiting participants for this study. We're really thrilled to be working with the VA Hospital and the Veterans Administration, which has really led the way for trying to improve dementia care, and now they're really trying to see about trying to prevent Alzheimer's disease.
Do you think that there is a sense of urgency among you and your colleagues to make some strides with this research now that we have more veterans from wars such as the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, who are still young but are getting older to maybe see if they can avoid or at least postpone potentially developing Alzheimer's?
Yes, I think you've really hit it, that there's a great urgency. I mean, not only are we at the beginning of the population in the United States being at higher risk for dementia because they're living longer, but we have more veterans who are surviving blast injuries who are coming back home. And a lot of them, again, do have some depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, vascular risk factors. So we really sense the urgency. Those of us who work with veterans regularly, like I do, who work in memory clinics and see the consequences of all these factors together and the impacts on families, I think our team has a real sense of urgency to partner with these veterans to find ways to prevent the disease and hopefully give them more good years of good quality of life.
Well, Dr. Carlson, we are going to leave it there for right now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Cindy Carlson is a geriatrics provider at the William S. Middleton Memorial Veterans Hospital and a researcher in the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. She talked to Central Times' J. Carlisle Larson about a new study researching the effects of fish oil supplements on the onset of Alzheimer's. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new investigation from Reveal finds that Black and Latino mortgage applicants were routinely denied loans from banks all over the country. Overt racial discrimination in lending was outlawed about 50 years ago, but this new investigation shows that there's still a huge racial gap in mortgage approvals. Aaron Glantz is a senior reporter for Reveal and the Center for Investigative Reporting. He was the lead reporter for Reveal's Kept Out series. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, I want to go back in history a bit, Aaron. We used to have this, as I said, overt system called redlining. Can you talk about what that was before it was technically outlawed?
Well, back in the 1930s, the government actually encouraged segregation and discrimination. The federal government, planners with the federal government went out to communities all over the country. They drew lines on maps, and they labeled some neighborhoods hazardous to lend in. And those hazardous neighborhoods were deemed hazardous because they had large numbers of African Americans or immigrants. And there was a whole color coding system. They were the red neighborhoods, so that's where we get the term redlining. There were also yellow neighborhoods where lenders were encouraged to stay away that had smaller proportions of people of color or restrictive covenants that were ending. And then there were blue and green neighborhoods that were populated mostly by white people that the government encouraged banks to lend in. And that happened during the Great Depression. Flash forward to the 1960s, the Civil Rights Movement. Discrimination based on housing is banned 50 years ago in 1968 by the Fair Housing Act. And yet here we are 50 years later, and in our latest report for Reveal, we find that the homeownership gap between blacks and whites is now greater than it was during the Jim Crow era, and many, many banks all across the country are more likely to deny people of color, even when they make as much money as their white counterparts, even when they're trying to buy in the same neighborhood, and even when they're trying to take on the same amount of debt.
And that's the heart of your report. You went through masses of data about mortgage applications and who got approved, who got rejected. Tell us a little more about what you found.
I mean, we looked through 31 million mortgage records covering nearly every loan application in America in 2015 and 2016, which are the most recent years data is available. And we honed in on conventional mortgage loans. These are, you know, loans that people are using to buy a house when they are trying to do it without any kind of special government program. And we looked at, you know, all of the factors that the government collects, including, as I mentioned, how much money people make and the neighborhood and the kind of economic and social characteristics of the neighborhood and the amount of the size of the loan and the relationship between how much money people made and the amount they were trying to borrow. And even after we did all of that, there were 61 cities across the country where people of color were more likely to be denied. In Wisconsin, this was true for Latinos. In Racine, Wisconsin, we found that even after all of these controls, Latinos were more likely to be turned away by a factor of two.
You talked to a lot of banks in this story, and it seems like a pretty common theme was, hey, it's not the race, it's credit score. But credit score isn't one of those things that the banks have to report in this data you looked at.
That's right. So in 1975, when the Congress passed the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, they didn't mandate credit score be collected. And so it was not available and hasn't been for decades. However, after the financial crisis, Congress passed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Bank Reform Act, right? And that was supposed to clean things up and prevent us from having another economic collapse. But even though Congress required in that law that banks start reporting credit score and some other important variables like the borrower's overall debt-to-income ratio, taking into account their student loans, for example, or car loans. Even though Congress mandated that banks turn this over, 7 years ago, we still don't have it, and the banks and the mortgage brokers have been fighting it every step of the way. So on the one hand, they say your analysis is not good enough because you didn't include this information. On the other hand, they're telling the federal government, hey, it's unfair, it's onerous, we shouldn't have to provide it, and anyway, even if we did, it wouldn't show anything interesting anyway.
Have banks been charged with discrimination in recent years?
Not often. Not often. There were a handful of cases brought under the Obama administration. We counted 9 lawsuits, fair lending lawsuits, during the entire 8 years of the Obama administration, and not a single one in the first year of President Trump.
And there was one Wisconsin bank, I think, that you tracked that that was on that list. Is that right?
That's right. So one of the few banks that has been sued by the federal government is Associated Bank out of Green Bay. It reached, actually, in 2015, the largest fair housing settlement in the history of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, $200 million. It promised to invest in low-income communities and communities of color when it was found to discriminate, or it actually settled a discrimination suit, rather. But we looked at the data in 2016, the year after that settlement, and we found that even then, Associated Bank made 32 times as many loans to whites as African Americans, and the bank's two largest markets are Chicago and Milwaukee, which obviously are, you know, very diverse communities.
You talked to some people, some individual people who had experiences, people of color who had experiences having their mortgage rejected or delayed over years. What kind of stories did you hear?
I think that the way I would characterize it is we heard a lot of people talking about a kind of runaround that they would get from their banker or their mortgage lender if they were a person of color, where it sometimes almost seemed like the lender was fishing for a reason to say no. I mean, always the reason for the denial was something that on its face would be eminently reasonable, like the person had a contract job and lenders like consistent W-2 income, or the person was new to an area, or the person had an old electric bill or a cell phone bill that they had failed to pay that had screwed up their credit. But then, on the other hand, we found white borrowers who had those same problems, and the loan officers would often work with them, try to resolve those problems, and the person would end up being able to buy the house. So we found that loan officers enjoyed a fair amount of discretion, and that discretion inevitably was more likely to work out more favorably if the borrower was white.
Let's dig into the credit score a little more. People use it as kind of an objective rating of our financial risk if somebody's giving us a loan. There's been some criticism, though, about what goes into that number. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that at this point the verdict is in that the credit score model that we use right now has some unfairness that is baked into the system, which is that the particular way that this data about you is inputted in is more likely to have a negative effect if you're a person of color than if you're white. And it has to do with the fact that there are certain types of credit, like mixed cell phone bills, missed electric bills, that only report when you don't pay. They don't report when you do pay. The biggest thing that doesn't report when you don't pay and does report, the biggest thing that only reports when you fail is rent. So basically, if you already own a home, every time you make a mortgage payment, your credit score goes up. So if you miss a payment, you have all the positive payments to jack it back up again. If you rent, that's not true. If you take out a payday loan, which people of color are targeted for payday loans, it only reports if you are negative. So a lot of people say that the credit score model that we use is not predictive of whether or not people of color will actually make their mortgage payments on time. And, even some of the banking industry will grant that, but they say that the problem, it's kind of a circular pointing of fingers. They'll point their finger back again to the government and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which buy 90% of conventional loans and insist on using the credit score that's calculated in this particular way.
Let's talk a little bit about consequences. Buying a home isn't just a place to live. It's, for many people, their primary asset that might be part of their retirement or borrowing against it for their kids' college, what have you. What are the long-term consequences if one group's got way better access to mortgages?
In America, home ownership and wealth are inextricably linked. We have an incredible amount of our wealth tied up in our homes. You know, your home is your retirement. Your home is the way that you can send your kids to college. Your home is a way to pay a medical expense that pops up out of the blue. And and the home ownership gap between blacks and whites, I mentioned, is bigger than it was during the Jim Crow era when segregation was legal and discrimination was legal. And so it's perhaps not surprising that even though, you know, the wealth, the income gap between blacks and whites is not gigantic, that the wealth gap is now, the average white family is now worth 15 times as much as the average black one, with Latinos not doing much better. And a lot of that is tied to home ownership.
And Aaron, as we wrap up, do you see anybody trying to tackle this as a problem?
Well, actually, I see a big crisis in this area right now. We focused our analysis on 2015 and 2016 when President Obama was president. We talked about how there were a few cases brought in his administration, including against Associated Bank. It's also true that the Community Reinvestment Act, which is the most important law designed to deal with this, where every single bank in America is graded for their performance, 99% of them under President Obama got a satisfactory or outstanding grade. Now here we are under President Trump, and we have a little bit of the fox guarding the hen house, where some of the same bankers, which the biggest disparities of lending between whites and people of color, are now in charge of implementing and monitoring these laws. So I think that our report that shows how pervasive this problem is, you know, we all need to keep our eye on the ball and ask, you know, are people in power doing enough from preventing this from continuing?
We'll leave it there for now. Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Aaron Glantz, senior reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting and Reveal. He joined us to talk about Reveal's new Kept Out series, which found that banks disproportionately refuse mortgages and loans to people of color. You can find links to that series at wpr.org/centraltime.